Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
Hi there, everybody. It's April 23rd, 2018, and we are back for what I believe is our ninth episode of the Jewelcast this year, and the first one to officially take place after the ending of the Kings season. We didn't expect it to be that abrupt. I don't think anybody did, even those who thought that the Vegas Golden Knights would run over the Kings. But a four-game sweep and three goals total scored by the Los Angeles Kings, and here we are. So let's go ahead and just tell you what to expect today. First of all, I'm going to be joined by Robin, who of course writes for Jewels from the Crown, and Sheng Peng, who used to write for Jewels from the Crown back in the day, and has since appeared at a number of outlets at Hockey Buzz, currently writing about the Vegas Golden Knights, which is a pretty good gig at the moment. He's also had his work appear on NHL.com, on Vice, and other outlets that I can ask him to plug as well. And you may have seen some of his 50 Forgotten Stories on the Kings website this year. So we'll get into that. Just a brief overview of where we are now. Of course, the offseason has begun for the Kings, but we still have the playoffs going on. Toronto earlier today, about 10 minutes ago, I believe, finished off a 3-1 win in Game 6. If you have not heard, Toronto had a pretty horrifying incident today in which a bus was driven onto the sidewalk and into a crowd. I do not know at this point how many people perished. I know it was 9 the last I heard, but again, a really, really terrible incident, and just keep them in your thoughts. We, you know, that can be expected to really cure any sort of feelings or damage in the wake of a tragedy like this, but it is something that was, I think, much needed for the city today. So the Toronto Maple Leafs will be playing in Game 7 in a couple days. Most of the other playoff series have come to an end. Washington is trying to hold on to a 5-3 lead against the Columbus Blue Jackets in the dying moments of Game 6. If they finish that off, Boston and Toronto will be the only series ongoing. So we know that Vegas and San Jose are going to be representing the Pacific Division in the second round. We're going to be asking Sheng about that series and about the outlook for the Vegas Golden Knights going forward, because he is our guest and we are going to talk about the Golden Knights, even if you guys don't really want to hear about them right now. But we will spend plenty of time on the Kings off season, as well as the plan going forward. I think we're going to have a longer off season podcast in the next couple weeks or so. But for now, we're going to focus mostly on that first round. So once Sheng gets on, we will launch into that. But the obvious steps forward are clear. The Kings' offense left them at the worst possible time after 82 games of a very slightly above average shooting percentage and some unexpectedly great performances from guys like Dustin Brown and Andrei Kopitar, who maybe were expected to contribute in Kopitar's case to lead the team, but not as effectively as they did. Kopitar had 2 points in the first round, and that was the team-leading total of 2 points because Jeff Carter, Tyler Toffoli, Tanner Pearson, more players than I can name for the Kings, sort of disappeared off the face of the earth in the first round. So it's fair, I think, for the argument to be, at least in the wake of the series, that something is wrong with the Kings' offense. It's not something that we had to deal with most of this year because even though the Kings' possession numbers did take a hit, their scoring numbers stayed pretty strong. And with little to no problems on the defensive end, at least in terms of goals against, where the Kings led the league in goals against, Jonathan Quick is going home with another Jennings Trophy because the goaltending was great and the defense was able to limit enough chances against. But even in the first round, after the Kings only allowed 7 goals, it just wasn't enough because for 2 games, the Kings had basically no offensive push to speak of. And by the time they came back home and managed to find some sort of offensive push, there was nothing coming from nothing being given to them, that is, by Marc-Andre Fleury, and the Golden Knights stayed pretty disciplined on defense, didn't give up too many chances, and even in Game 4, where I saw a much better offensive effort, and arguably the Kings did deserve on the balance to win that game, they were still shut out 1-0, and there was nothing coming. So sort of the question that arises is 4 games of totally inept offensive effort enough to outweigh 82 pretty decent games on the offensive end? So it's going to be a bit of a battle going forward in the Kings fan base to decide sort of where the blame falls on that. And I think that's the good thing about us waiting a few days to do this podcast is we're able to stand back a little bit from the immediate pain of losing 4 games in a row to a rival that no one is expecting, or no one was expecting, to be the Kings' rival so soon. It brings to mind the 2016 series loss at the hands of the San Jose Sharks, who took 5 games to beat the Kings, but again exposed some serious issues with the Kings. The Kings were able to only win 1 game in overtime in that series. And yes, that means the Kings have not won a regulation playoff game since Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals. So that's just a brief overview, a brief 9-minute overview of what we're going to talk about. For now, let's go ahead and launch into the sort of retrospective portion of this with the Kings and the Golden Knights, because I believe that is Sheng who's just called in. Sheng, are you there?
Yes, it's me. Sorry I'm late. I just posted the second part of my Sharks Golden Knights preview, so please read it. Sorry to rub it in, guys.
Must be nice to be writing playoff preview content, Sheng.
Yes, it is. It is. You should try it sometime.
I did it a lot. Many, many moons ago, I wrote previews of final series and semifinal series. Well, thanks for coming on somewhat
time
short
ago
notice,
in the galaxy
Sheng.
Far away.
Well, I apologize to everybody who tuned out while I was monologuing there, but I think I pretty much introduced everything that we were going to talk about in some context. So let's launch right into it, Sheng. What were your immediate feelings after this first round? Was there any sort of indication that this was going to be as short a series as it was to you?
I think once Doughty got suspended, that became a possibility. We saw in Game 2, just, you don't want to take too much from a 1-game sample size, but you saw how much the Kings missed Doughty. And once you go down 2-0, then, you know, the Kings played fine in Game 3, but you lose Game 3 and there you go. Series is over.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk a little bit about sort of the personnel the Kings had to rotate in and the adjustments they had to make. Mm-hmm. But nobody, I think, thought they we're going to win game two. Even when we were 10 minutes into double overtime, it was still not looking like the Kings are going to be able to get away with that one. But in games 3 and 4, because we know games 1 and 2 were sort of dominant for the Golden Knights, do you think games 3 and 4 were a truer sort of representation of the Knights, or do you think that the Kings were just sort of showing some desperation and by that reason were able to hang in there a little bit more?
I think so. I think it was a true representation of the series. One of the interesting stats that shows how much Game 2 skewed things is that there's a new Twitter handle. I think it's called The Point Hockey. They have a lot of great stuff. You know, a lot of you guys probably already seen it. One of the things they track are slot shots. And they did a kind of a roundup of the whole series. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think the Golden Knights had like something like a 68-32 edge in shots from the slot during the series. That sounds tremendous. That sounds like a Kings team that was roundly dominated from games 1 through 4. But I went back to look back just to check, double check, and the difference now, I said I think 68-32, so that's a plus 36 difference for the Golden Knights. The difference in game 2 between the two teams in slot shots was plus 22 for the Golden Knights. So that shows you how much of a how much game 2 skewed things. They also had a stat that Vegas had 20-3 odd man rushes on the Kings. I wonder how much of that happened in game 2 with especially with the overtimes too. I would say game 1 too was actually excellent representation of two teams too. The first two periods of game 1 I thought were well played by both teams. And it wasn't until the third period of game 1 that Golden Knights were able to emphasize their speed on LA.
Yeah, and I think sort of the running theme of this podcast, at the very least, is going to be whether this is sort of a larger picture of what the next few years are going to be like in the Pacific Division, and whether whether this is a concern for the Kings, the number of odd man rushes they allowed in this series. And you look at the regular season series, and I think it was, aside from the obvious difference, which is the lack of goals in this series, you saw a lot of these things in earlier matchups. You saw Vegas managing to recover pucks to get a territorial advantage on a team that's used to having a territorial advantage. And the counterattacks, something that the Kings did a little bit more effectively this season, but it's still not really their forte, and LA having to try and find chances in the counterattacks. So it was four games of just, it felt like a slog because it was constantly looking for the Kings to score a goal, any goal, please. But were you satisfied with the sort of entertainment value of this series?
Well, I would have liked to have seen, just for the entertainment value, more from Jeff Carter. He's a remarkable player when he's on. Obviously, he was still recovering from his injury. And so it would have been a much tighter series in that case. I think he's the one person that certainly could have made a difference and didn't for good reason. But I think I would like to have seen a little bit more of that. And I think that's the main thing. I mean, besides that, though, the goaltending was terrific. I mean, when we first got this matchup, I had a little worry because both Fleury and Quick, as great as they have been in the playoffs, they've also had their flameouts too. And wouldn't it have been so disappointing if either one of them had this huge kind of flameout? And neither did, though. And that was great to watch. Too bad, Quick couldn't get one or two in on Fleury, but still, it was great to watch them match save for save.
Yeah, and statistically, it was one of Quick's best playoff series ever. I think it was his third best series ever by save percentage. He gave up, as I mentioned a couple times in the beginning of the podcast, 7 goals, and his I think he gave up 7 goals on 131 shots in the series. In the 2012 Stanley Cup Finals, he gave up 7 goals on 132 shots. So he was playing as well as he ever has in the playoffs. And given, I think, the situation and the sort of shorthandedness of the Kings at various points of the series, it was as impressive as he's been in a while. But Fleury, let's talk about him briefly, because the main storyline of the series, I think, was Fleury's play, even if a lot of people sort of went with more of a theme of Vegas overtaking the Kings and feeling their torch or whatever it was.
LA.
Yeah.
The NHL wants
everyone's
Vegas
favorite
for final.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think Toronto fans are pretty upset about the refereeing too. So let's go ahead and just round up all the aggrieved teams in this one. But you think Fleury is going to maintain anywhere near this level of play in the next round?
No, I mean, that's just statistically impossible. The last time I saw somebody maintain this level of play for a long stretch of time was probably Jagr in 2003, where for 3 rounds he was a wall. And, of course, he ran into a wall in the final against the Devils. Goalies just can't play like that for that long. Even Quick in 2012, Quick had amazing numbers for throughout the playoffs. But even in the finals, he ran into a little bit of a wall from what I remember. And also, too, the Kings' defense was pretty much bulletproof throughout that run.
Yeah, and if you can maintain that success for 4 rounds, you're going to win a Conn Smythe, because that's what Jagr did, and that's what Quick did in 2012. So it's either you're winning a Conn Smythe or you're going to hit a bit of a wall at some point.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
I guess
the same
rephrasing
percentage is 97%,
question.
So.
Yeah, but I guess rephrasing the question then, is he someone you expect to be a difference maker in this? I'm trying. I can't ask questions like you, Sting. I know you're good at that.
Not that great.
So is
to some people.
Yeah. We'll talk about that in a bit. But is he going to be if the Golden Knights win this series, is it going to be because of Fleury, or is it going to be because of the attack or the defense? Like, what is going to be the difference maker if Vegas wins the series, do you think?
Well, I'm going to say again, game one of the Kings Knights series, what impressed me about the Golden Knights, and I wrote this, that this was maybe, just maybe, kind of a shot out to the West, a sign to the West of things to come. Vegas, I talked about that game and how Vegas was able to play defensively with the Kings for 2 periods. And when the Kings gave them an inch, the Kings were down in that game, the Kings gave them an inch, and Vegas took a yard with their counterattack. The best teams can win in different ways. We know that Vegas can score. We know that Fleury can save their butts if necessary. If Vegas is able to defend as well as they did against the Kings at times, obviously they didn't do a good job of that in game 4, period 1, but they could do defend as well as they did for most of the series against the Kings, then that's something that can carry them through too. Of course, you don't always win in one way. And so something else that is interesting about Vegas too is, if you look at their special teams, they had a top 10 power play during the season. Their penalty killing was the third best in the league from early December on. So there's a lot of ways for Vegas to win, I guess, to answer your question. A lot of ways they can win. They're not a team that is dependent just on their goalie. Even if Fleury was just decent against the Kings, you probably still see Vegas winning, maybe a 6-game series or whatever, right? Right, Eric?
Oh, what? No, sorry. I had muted my microphone, but yes, I think that's about right. I think the Kings, in a less extraordinary effort, Fleury, take game 2 or game 4, or they managed to take either game three or game two, which arguably they didn't deserve to win quite as much, but managed to keep it within a goal. So, yes, I agree.
But anyway, the overall point is that Vegas can win in different ways. They're not a one-dimensional team.
Yeah, and I think the Kings tried to sort of take on Vegas on all fronts, you could say, and they did reasonably well in a lot of the battles. Obviously, special teams was all right in over the balance of the series. I think that they lost the penalty battle, but managed to keep things close. The defending, despite some personnel shortages, was fairly disciplined against a team that was dangerous in Vegas. But you obviously saw one big shortcoming for the Kings, and that was the offense.
Right.
As we go on, I think we'll ask a couple more questions about the Vegas Golden Knights, because that is your specialty at the moment. But I do want to welcome Robin onto the podcast, as she's just called in. Robin, you there?
I'm here.
Hey, Robin. Finally.
Perfect.
Hello.
So we have many, many years of Jewels from the Crown experience currently on the podcast. You could say we've got a veteran presence going.
Oh, my God.
We have a lot of leadership and grit in here.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that did the Kings a lot of good in the playoffs. So hopefully we'll thrive just as much.
Hopefully this podcast lasts longer than the Kings' playoff run.
Well, we've got somewhere between 60 and 90 minutes, which I feel like is about the same length. So let's briefly go back. And Robin, we talked a little bit about the first round already, but I want to get your perspective now that we're a few days out from the elimination. We've talked a little bit about how Vegas was able to win this series, but what were your immediate impressions of the Kings coming off of this series loss?
It just looked lost. Like, I have to give Vegas credit, you know, for disrupting the breakout and stuff. But once they got in the, if they managed to get into the offensive zone, they just kind of looked at each other and were like, what next? And it's like, no, you know what to do next. Mm-hmm. You've done this a few times. And I swear, an unbeatable God. Like, try it. Try putting a few shots. And game four notwithstanding, they just kind of looked a little lost on what to do.
So Shang already brought up Jeff Carter's I almost said Jeff Carter's absence, but Jeff Carter's
that would be accurate.
Ineffectiveness. It would be, yeah. But Jeff Carter, obviously. What was that?
Nothing. I was making a dumb joke.
You're more than welcome to make dumb jokes. But I guess aside from Carter, Robin, which player were you most disappointed by in the first round?
Everybody in the bottom six. Like, Amadio didn't really do anything. Kepe didn't do anything. Clifford didn't do anything. Like, can somebody do anything? Toffoli tried, but it just seems like something was just not clicking there. And so, but the whole bottom six was just kind of a mess.
Yeah, and I think it sort of speaks to a larger point, and Vegas knows something about having a bottom six that can sort of make a difference in these games. And talking about Kempe, who had a 30-game goalless drought, and other players who don't bring any offense and others who are supposed to bring offense, Shang, what do you think the Vegas bottom six sets them up to do in the future? Like, the way the expansion process worked, do you think that's the biggest advantage that the Golden Knights had this season and in this playoff run, was having a fairly balanced depth in their lineup?
Definitely the expansion draft helped getting better players than other expansion teams have been able to get. But I think what also helped too was having a plan for the players. They picked players that could play a certain way. And most of them have been able to play fast. They picked guys like Belmar, England, guys who were less than analytics darlings, guys that we didn't know who could play fast. And turns out that they can play fast. And so that makes a difference. They had an identity from day one, and they've stuck with it, and they have players who can fill that out. I think with the Kings, one of their problems is, as Robin alluded to, it's not like the bottom six. These are not bad players, but it's kind of a mess of different styles. There are a couple of holdovers from the Darryl years, a couple of skill guys, a couple of non-skill guys, and just didn't really gel.
Yeah, and it's not easy, I think, to move on from one coach to another. And even with, I know, Robin, you've mentioned in the past that Stevens does have a pretty similar style to Sutter in a lot of ways. But when you've had somebody who's been coaching the team for 6+ years, sort of the transition, if you are trying to establish a new culture or a new style of play, it is in pretty surprising in a lot of ways that the Kings were able to be as good as they were for certain stretches of the season, given there was sort of a dissonance there. Robin, do you have an issue with the way the bottom six was deployed? Would you have done anything different in terms of style, or do you think, like Sheng said, it's just sort of an issue of the players not going together so well?
Well, I think it's more about Stevens' breakout plan in general. So I forgot who it was, but I was looking on Twitter, and Bob chimed in, so shout out to Bob Knob out there. There you go, Bob. There's your shout out.
Always.
So I saw some talking about it, and somebody had like a crudely drawn graphic that they'd done in Paint. It was like basically once the center gets into the zone, he kind of breaks to the wall and tries to dish off to the weak side winger, hoping he's there, which worked for Kopitar and Brown because, well, Brown's not exactly an elite player. He knows what to do so many years playing with Kopitar, and they have a really good chemistry. The bottom six had almost zero chemistry all season long, and then you add in that they're trying to hope and pray that the weak side winger is there and everybody's kind of in chaos and they don't quite know where they're going or they don't quite have the skill to pull it off, and you get something that's kind of like, what are you doing, Nate Thompson? Like, why are you trying to drop back, throw it blindly into the gates of Tempest? Oh, God, what are you doing?
And I just I found the post you were looking for. It was by a longtime commenter, Last Place Finish, who posted that drawing, like you said. Yeah, talking about the sort of Kings style, and it's tough because the Kings clearly tried some new things. I think more noticeably in the offensive zone, and those are sometimes the easier things to notice. The passes to the middle of the ice and the attempts to have guys in front making deflections. Jeff Carter and Dustin Brown scored a bunch of goals this year on tips. But we noticed more and more as the season went on, guys like Martinez and Phaneuf, who were getting trapped in their own zone, sort of because they were doing a bend don't break kind of style, and for whatever reason, failing to get the puck out of the zone. And it was something that I agree was really an issue in the series in terms of generating chances. Sheng, has this been something you've noticed all season with the Vegas Golden Knights, the team being able to just restrict other teams from getting out of their zone that easily?
No. I mean, Vegas was up and down. I think one of the questions about Vegas going into the series, and one reason why a lot of people picked the Kings, is over the last 20 games or so, Vegas's underlying stats kind of collapsed a bit. I think Ryan Lambert wrote something about that. And their high danger Corsi 4 percentage was last in the league, I think, from March 1st on. So going into this, the LA Vegas series, I think it was a question of which Vegas team did you think was real? The team from the first 60 games or so, which was top 10 in pretty much all underlying stat categories, or the team in the last month or so, which was pretty bad in those categories, even if the record didn't show it. And I believe more in the team from that I had watched for the first 4 months of the season. And I think that we are seeing more of that team right now. But there was a little bit of a question with that, and I don't think it was a sure thing that the Vegas would be able to play so well defensively throughout this series. I mean, if you look at them still on the roster and talking to them, to some people, they still thought that Vegas's defense would be easily penetrated by the Kings. And, you know, you look at Vegas' defense, a bunch of no-name guys like Nate Schmidt, or no-name before this season, Nate Schmidt, Braden McNabb, Shea Theodore, you know, no stars. But the defense held strong.
And do you put any credence in the argument that Vegas was not playing as well down the stretch because they had less to play for?
I don't know. Yeah, that's what Gallant said. It's possible, but I don't know. I know that's not much of an answer for radio, but
that's a fair answer.
But I'll just say it's possible, and let's just say that they did not play as well, and I'm sure there were reasons for it. But they were an excellent team for most of the first 60 games of the season, and we saw against LA, we saw a return of that team. And so if you're a Vegas fan or if you're betting on them, I think that what they were able to do against LA should fill you with some confidence. And again, that's why after game one, I thought that game kind of could put the West on notice, even though, again, it's one game and whatnot. But I saw in that game a return of a Vegas attention to defense, to detail, that I hadn't seen for a while. I almost forgot that they could do. And if they can do that on occasion and mix that in with some offense, mix that in with some flurry, mix that in with some, you know, some special teams work, they can go far.
Yeah. And Robin, sort of on the flip side of that, the Kings had to play a lot of really meaningful games coming into the playoffs. They didn't clinch until in between game 80 and game 81. They were playing almost every game against a rival for playoff positioning or a division rival. Do you think the Kings just sort of ran out of steam, especially with Forbert out and Muzzin injured and Doughty suspended? Or do you think that even a healthy Kings team would have lost the series?
It's kind of hard to say. I mean, I thought they would be energized by Carter returning, and for like half a game it looked like they were, and then it was back to old habits, and they were the same old frustrating team that we've seen all season long, except as per usual, Jeff Carter was carrying them and making up for their mistakes, and then Jonathan Quick came in and decided to like be playoff hero as much as could in the series, but I don't want to sound negative, but at the same time, I don't know if I quite believe in them enough to say that they would have a healthier team would have extended the series further. But it's really hard to say because they just look so completely discombobulated, and I don't know if it's because they just ran out of steam or if it was just the way they were, because that's how they were playing before they got into the playoffs. And I was like, I think it was game 75 or something. They were like 3 points out. And I was like, these guys aren't going to make it. And to be honest with you, they probably wouldn't have if they hadn't gotten a big help from the rest of their division just kind of slowly failing.
Yeah, and there was, I think, about the point where the Kings technically had like a 75% chance of making the playoffs, but there were three other teams that all had a 75% chance of making the playoffs, and it was three teams or four teams for three spots. So there's a sense around the fan base, at least going in, there was a sense of the Kings have done really well just to make the playoffs. And then four losses later, I think we kind of chucked that out the window because of how total and how totally hopeless the playoff showing was in a lot of ways.
Four losses.
Before we move. Oh no, we've got a bunch of them. Robin, I think we've got a bunch of them saved up, and we're not going to bore you with all of them on this one. But we'll save that for
tomorrow. Then it's holding it like a Trump card, almost like a the playoffs got you down and out. Well, here's a bunch of our theories.
Solid. So stay tuned for that, everybody. I guess before we move on to the plan going forward for the Kings and Shang, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on that too, from a less inside perspective. The Golden Knights and the Kings rivalry, we talked about it a lot on our playoff preview podcast with Knights on Ice, the Vegas SB Nation site, and sort of what this is going to do for the rivalry between these two teams going forward. Even though it was such a short series, I was going to say that I couldn't believe how much Kings fans have managed to despise the Golden Knights in such a short time. But then I found myself feeling a lot of those feelings too. So maybe I'm not so surprised.
Well, if we remember how quickly the Kings fans got to hate Ducks fans, then that might be a good ruler too. It didn't take Kings fans that long to hate on the Ducks back in the mid '90s.
The Ducks fans think that there's a rivalry with the Kings, and Kings fans are like, no, go away. You're like the annoying little brother we didn't ask for.
Well, the Kings fans are wrong, though, because the Ducks won a cup first. I hate to be the one
to
bring that up, but
that should be more annoying. It's more successful, at least at first.
No, let's be honest. The part reason why there was a rivalry was the Ducks were more successful for roughly from the time they came into the league till Lombardi took. I mean, till the Kings for Kings first cup. In that time, they had Kriya, Solani. At that point, the Kings were falling apart. They lost Gretzky. They lost ownerships. They had no money. They had a little bump with the Andy Murray years, but they didn't get that far. The Ducks at that time, they made it to the finals in 2003. They made it to the conference finals, I think, around that time with Pierce Golov. I don't remember what year that was. And eventually, of course, they won a cup in 2007. So for a good two decades, actually, Anaheim was a better team. It just so happened that they played in a market where nobody paid attention to them. But
it's true.
And all I am going to try and argue here is that the Ducks still have not beaten the Kings in a playoff series. And that's my only thing that I can bounce back to in the here's why the Kings don't, or Kings fans, at least some Kings fans, don't feel like it's as valid a rivalry, because we saw it with Arizona 6 years ago, where there was no sort of real venom between the fan bases. And no, Kings fans don't see Arizona as a rival, but it was a very organic hate that sprung from that series and from the losing end. And I think a similar thing has happened here. Do you think the Golden Knights fans, Shang, are seeing the Kings as their true enemies at this point? Or has it not been established yet?
Yeah, I think so, more so too, because of all the teams in the Pacific, LA is the closest geographically, I believe. Yes, it is. And obviously a lot of Golden Knights fans. I mean, Vegas was closer to being Kings territory than any other Pacific team before the Golden Knights. And there's been a number of Kings fans that have jumped ship to the Golden Knights. Not me. I'm a journalist.
Traitor!
But But a number of them have. And so I think that kind of feeds it too. And I guess I brought up the point with the Ducks because I think Kings fans, you know, being one for so long too, I think that we have this inferiority complex. And so when there's like this a new shiny toy, this little brother that comes along, and he has a Paul Kariya, or he has, you know, he's the Vegas Golden Knights, and you know, with all this playoff success, you know, the feelings of inadequacy or something, you know, spring to the well. And personally, I was surprised by it because I thought that winning a couple of cups would, you know, chill everybody the fuck out, to be honest. I mean, winning the cups chilled me out. I'm going to be honest. Like, yeah, I mean, and I was as big a Kings fan as anybody. And they've chilled me out over the last couple of years. But apparently it hasn't with most other people.
We got spoiled.
I guess
we did get spoiled, and in 2015, I think people let it sort of slide off.
You have no right to. You have no right to be spoiled, though. I mean, look at our history.
Oh no, we suck.
Exactly, 45 years.
Shang, it's nice hearing you talk like a Kings fan, even though you're a real professional. It's fun.
He's a traitor, Eric. Don't listen.
I know, I can't believe I even let you back on the podcast, Shane.
Well, you obviously we're need of guests, right? So it's off season, so you have a lot of time to fill, right, after a 4-game sweep.
Yeah, we have about a week less than we had to fill last summer, so that's progress, I think. The last Vegas question I'm going to ask, at least until maybe a little bit later. I think it was Danny Webster, the editor of Knights on Ice, posted a little video from practice today, showing Lions outdoor basically for entry into the Vegas practice today. If there was an excitement for the Golden Knights going into the playoffs, how has the sweep sort of jacked all that up?
You know, there were big crowds. It was building throughout the season. I think as Las Vegans, as they're called, as Las Vegans noticed that the team kept winning and kept surprising people, practice would start to become full, especially on weekends. And this was happening mid-season. But I think what the playoffs have done that I've noticed is that they've galvanized the crowd even more. I mean, there's even more throughout practice, you know, go Knights, go chants, cheers. Just when Fleury makes a big save, there's cheers during practice. When Fleury makes a save on his own teammate that is not going out 100% to try to score on him, there's big cheers. And so I think that's where it's at. It's not necessarily an attendance thing, because the attendance thing has been pretty strong throughout the season, and it's really, like I said, ratcheted up as the team has kept winning. I think it is just that you hear it just come out vocally, fans cheering, that sort of thing. It is amazing. You're standing around practice, and all of a sudden, there's somebody starting a Go Knights chant in the middle of practice. And so, yeah, anyway, I think that's where the excitement's at.
And do you,
can I
put you on the spot,
Danny's picture today, yeah, about the line, that's not a normal thing. The reason for that was actually because it was team photo day or something. There's some kind of photo. Actually, I don't know if it was team photo day, but there's some kind of official photo being taken, and they had like black curtains around the ice and so it wasn't an injury thing or anything, because everybody's healthy on Vegas. But so those lines aren't quite normal.
Sheng is always taking us behind the curtain. So let's talk now. We've got a few minutes left to go. Let's talk about the way forward. First for the Kings, and then just talking about the Pacific Division as a whole. So, Robin, what's the immediate priority for the Kings after the way the season ended?
Well, Blake said it was secondary offense, and I'm like, of course, you know, I'm bitter, and I hate Nate Thompson because I hate everything. basically, you can't get by with a guy like Nate Thompson. Yes, he came in, and he didn't, like, drag the team down as much as I was expecting him to, but you cannot keep filling the roster with Nate Thompson's and Torrey Mitchell's and Deion Phaneuf's and then be surprised when your team isn't scoring. And it was weird because it seemed like for most of the season that Stevens had brought their shooting percentage out of the basement. And I'm like, well, okay, that's not all he did. All he did was kind of took off the handcuffs, so to speak. He didn't really do anything sort of galvanize their offense, and I even from the beginning I was kind of like a little wary about that. So number one priority, to sum it up, is offense, secondary offense.
And for you, I mean, you mentioned that the top six being an issue in the first round, or the bottom six being an issue in the first round. But yeah, it's with the Kings, a lot of their offense has been driven from the defensemen. Even in a year like this, where we had a few guys like Martinez and Phaneuf who didn't bring as much scoring to the table, Phaneuf, looking it up, had three assists in 26 games at even strength. He did some scoring on the power play. In the proud tradition of guys like Vinny Lecavalier and Jerome Iginla, who are old veterans that came in and provided a jump start on the power play. I think Phaneuf did that, but there, you know, the offensive struggles stemmed from a lot of places, and Drew Doughty and Jake Muzzin both had very productive seasons offensively, but I wonder what's going to happen on defense, because you have Phaneuf and Forbert and Martinez has had some good offensive seasons. Forbert has had his moments, but none of them are expected to sort of drive things. And we saw in this series, we saw Oscar Fantenberg get a bunch of time. We saw Paul Ledoux score a goal. We saw, some potential bright spots there from guys who have been healthy scratches or who have been in Ontario for large portions of the season. So I wonder what is going to be the plan going forward there. It doesn't immediately look like there's room for a guy like Oscar Fantenberg. Christian Follin didn't score either, but he was pretty reliable and I think gained the trust of the coaching staff. Assuming that the Kings aren't able to trade Deion Phaneuf's contract, what, Robin, would you do with the defense?
Okay, so probably what they're going to do is they're probably going to let Follin walk, because he's good anyway. So they'll probably, more than likely, they're probably going to let Follin walk. I think everybody else is under contract except for Gravel and Paul.
That's right.
Let me check cap reps real quick. All right, pulling it up as we see.
Ledoux is an RFA, you're right. But
yeah.
Gravel is unrestricted free agent.
I don't know what they're going to do with Gravel. Gravel had his ups and downs on the ice this season. I don't know how much of that stems from lack of playing time, but he obviously struggled in the playoffs when it mattered the most and when everybody's under the biggest scrutiny. So my guess is they'll try to re-sign him, but I wouldn't easily re-sign Paul Ledoux. And then, Phaneuf and Doughty is the big key here. And it all depends on the cap, because they can re-sign Doughty starting July 1st. He's currently making $7 million.
Yeah.
Carlson is, I believe, an unrestricted free agent this year. So Doughty's contract is going to depend quite heavily on what Carlson does. So in terms of defense, I mean, they've already signed Daniel Brickley, and they all but assured him a spot on the NHL roster because they didn't even send him to Ontario. They just were like, cool, you played college. We'll see you next year after they were out of the playoffs.
And Daniel Brickley is a point per game scorer in the NHL. I think people forget that.
He's
got one whole point.
I was there for that game.
Yeah, it was a
I'm going to remember that forever. What game was it?
I don't remember. It was a real coming out party for Daniel Brickley.
Oh,
I think it was the Minnesota
the
game.
Because I was excited about the game. I thought that it was going to be a good it was going to be a good playoff test. It would be a good awards evaluation kind of game. But it was Minnesota, LA. But it was after both teams had clinched. So, yeah. So to go back to what you asked me about Vegas not try as hard in the last month, in that game I could see that both Minnesota and LA, it was not a game really worth watching. So.
Well, you know who did try in that game was Dustin Brown.
Oh, that's right. And I imagine Daniel Brickley,
we
too.
Got
I'm
one.
Sure he gave it his gave it the good old college try in that game too.
Nice.
Yep.
Fun there.
So Sheng, we got to see a lot of Fantenberg and Ledoux this season. I don't know how much you saw of Fantenberg earlier this season or Ledoux later in the season. What do you think the outlook is for a guy like Fantenberg, who seems to be squeezed out but then comes in and plays 40 minutes a game too?
He is a guy that I liked over the summer. I watched enough Kings games to wonder what, honestly, Curtis McDermott was doing out there ahead of him.
Fair.
You know, his ceiling is probably still going to be a bottom six, and the Kings have a few of those guys. The Kings look pretty locked into their top five right now, so there's not a lot of space. Brickley is going to be in a conversation, obviously. Follin, I would think they would want to re-sign him, though he might be a little richer than they want to spend on a bottom-pairing guy. Stantonberg could definitely take a spot there. They still have Clegg in the system, too, and obviously Ledoux, too. So, I don't know. I think that he could be somebody that they do let walk just because he's a good player, and I think that they did bury him in Ontario unnecessarily for too long. But he's also not a special player that necessarily needs to be accommodated.
Are you talking about Fantenberg
or
somebody else?
Yeah, I'm
talking about Fantenberg. Sorry if you're listening, Oscar. You seem like a nice guy, but...
Well,
yeah, Robin, your thoughts?
Oh, sorry. I totally, jumped the gun there, Eric. he's interesting because... The mayor, he said... He was quoted as saying after he got laid the right way, he's in it 100%. He was not... He was actually, promised by other teams, or at least that's what he indicated, that he would get NHL playing time. And he says, no... I took the Kings because I wanted to learn to play the game the right way, which I thought was very interesting. I mean, he's 25 years old, which is considered old for the NHL. I mean, at least for a rookie, anyway. And a rookie coming off of okay. I mean, he wasn't exactly who's the Dolan? He's no Dolan, you know? So... It's interesting because he says he wants to learn to play the right way. So what that means for the Kings and what they do with Vandenberg?
I will interject that I know the Kings they loved how Vandenberg played in the playoffs for the most part, except for being sidestepped by James Neal, being moonwalked by James Neal there.
He's victimized.
But anyway, though. I think though that Vandenberg might come back because he'll be cheap, and you can do way worse with your sixth through eighth defenseman than Vandenberg. And so a guy like Folan might leave because Folan might be able to get a regular NHL job somewhere. A guy like Gravel, I think, is probably going to be, I would just guessing, is probably going to be iced out from the Kings just because there isn't really the space for him. But
yeah,
a guy like Vandenberg, part of the advantage of actually burying him in Ontario in so long is that he didn't get to play a lot of games and he didn't get to show perhaps his full value. And so if you can bring him back for something close to what he was making this year, then, yeah, you can do, like I said, way worse 6-8 than him.
Okay, so wait, Shane, I'm looking it up right
mm-hmm.
now. So you,
mm-hmm.
you were talking about Folan might be a little rich for the Kings. Right now, he signed as a UFA at 27 for $850K. They have
mm-hmm.
Stanton signed for $925. The difference is that Stantonberg is an RFA, so they still own his rights. And I think when it comes down to it, it'll probably be between the guy who's slightly younger with about a similar ceiling and who they own the rights to versus Folan, who might, as you say, probably can get a job, a regular NHL job somewhere else and probably would be more interested in that.
Yeah, it's where you can save your money. If Folan was willing to come back for the exact same money as Vandenberg, I'm sure they'd take Folan every day of the week. There's a reason why Folan was in the lineup for the whole season and why Vandenberg was in Ontario. But I imagine Folan might get maybe $1.5 million, even $1.25 million, which doesn't sound like a lot more. But when you're a team like the Kings that's always against the cap, you got to save money where you can.
Yeah, definitely.
Man, you guys make my job easy. I can just start the conversation and lean back for a while.
There was a lot of silence after the Folan-Fantenberg discussion, the Folan-Fantenberg wars there.
I had to let it settle.
I really did. no, we have other things to talk about, Robin. So let's then, I guess, if we've got the defense kind of sorted out and we'll leave the Doughty discussion for another day because it's going to be, I think, the hot topic, especially after July 1st comes and goes.
It's a little long,
but let's talk. We'll have our time, I promise. But let's just quickly go over the forward situation. Everybody signed except for Reeder, who is a restricted free agent, Torrey Mitchell, who is unrestricted. And then you've got your assortment of tweeners. You know, Michael Mersch is, I think, not coming back, for example. But this is going to be kind of the same team next year. For better or for worse, for the last 6 years or so, it's been very much the same team, and it's going to be again. Robin, what's your outlook for the Kings next season? Are they going to be in a similar spot? I don't think anybody's going to pick them to win the division, but do you expect them to be this sort of bubble playoff team again?
Probably. I mean, the expectation coming into the season was that they'd be lucky to make the playoffs, and they got up to a hot start, and then they basically went about .500 for the rest of the season, and I was like, I don't like this ride. Get me off this ride. This was a fun day. But I mean, I was kind of down on the Reeder trade, but he surprised me. So if they can get him again for about $2 million, or because I think Arizona may have held back a little money. I'm not quite sure, but he's making just shy of 1.9 right now. So if they can get him about Trevor Lewis money, I think he'd be really valuable to bring back. As far as Torrey Mitchell goes, that was a really weird trade because they were like, we need someone who can take face off. Like that's the least of my concerns. But okay, guys, you do you.
And yeah, I think they're going to be here for fairly cheap because he didn't light up the score sheet while I was in LA. I'll check. He had 4 goals for the Kings in 20 games and 2 assists, and I think they sort of came in spurts for Reeder. So it was interesting down the stretch. I think everybody was sort of salivating over a Reeder-Kempe combination just for the speed they'd be able to bring, and neither of them really responded to that lineup as well as I think we were hoping. But I think with the way the game is going, I do think that Reeder fits in to the future plan of the Kings pretty well. And I think as far as those bottom six options go,
I wanted to step in and say that speaking of Reeder,
yeah, go ahead, Shane.
I was very impressed with Blake's work this year, actually, even though it didn't lead to much more than, you know, what it led to. I thought that under the circumstances with a team that I think if you look at realistically is not a cup contender, he didn't overextend himself to try to open the window, keep the window open for longer. He kept Vilardi at the deadline, which, you know, everybody wanted Vilardi. He made little trades on the margins that added a little more talent, a little more reliability, even though Fanouf isn't the most popular players.
Yeah.
Trading him for Gabrick's contract straight up, I think, was great because you get somebody in Fanouf who can still play 20 minutes fairly capably, even though he can be exposed. But he can still eat up these minutes and do a decent job of it. You know, Gabrick was a guy who wasn't even playing and wasn't even playing in Ottawa all the time for a team that was awful, obviously.
He got
He got injured. And then a guy like Reeder, who is youngish, who's had a lot of good seasons in Arizona before this season was sort of a down season for him. And so they were able to acquire this guy who, you know, with a bit of potential, with a bit of upside, with a bit of speed for their backup goalie, a backup goalie that they were never going to re-sign anyway. And so they kind of rolled the dice that, well, there's about 20 games left in the season. There's about 4 games left for the backup. Okay, we're going to roll the dice that Quick's going to hold up. Campbell won't get destroyed. And Reeder can help us in the bottom six. Now, Reeder wasn't great over the last 20 games or so and over the playoffs. He wasn't exceptional by any means. But I think that these little kind of moves, considering the box that Blake is in, considering all the bad contracts the Kings have, considering that they need to save money to sign Doughty, I think that he did pretty well under the circumstances.
Can I add something to that about the backup goalie? So,
sure.
You guys know Kat Silverman, right? She's like
sure.
kind of the goalie whisperer of the NHL. And
Kat's awesome.
Yeah. So she mentioned to me, because I was like really concerned about, because our backup goalie was having a really good year. Kemper was having an outstanding year. Granted, it was a career year for him, and the Kings are a pretty good defensive team, but I was like, why are we, you know, jettisoning off a decent guy when we should be resting Quick and, like, being more concerned about the playoffs? And she said that, you know, they really, the Kings wouldn't, take this gamble with Campbell, God, I can't believe myself. They wouldn't take the risk with Campbell if they weren't absolutely sure that Dusty Emu had promised him that he was ready. Not Dusty Emu had told the Kings he was very certain that Campbell was 100% ready for this. And they said they trusted, she said that they trusted Emu to know his job. And she said he's actually one of the best development coaches out there.
Yeah, I mean, when I was covering the Reign, Dusty was one of the best guys to talk to. And we saw what he did with Budaj's career. We saw what he did with Campbell's career. He turned two guys who looked like they were pretty much done with the NHL into NHL backups once again. And so, yeah, if Dusty said so, that sounds right on to me. And for a Kings team that we saw, obviously, against Vegas, that their bottom six needs a lot of help. Needed a lot of help, still needs a lot of help. Taking a gamble on a guy like Reeder was a great gamble. Just didn't work out. You know, I don't think he played as well as he could have with the Kings. But, again, he's had a kind of a rough season, and he's youngish. So I do agree that bringing him back for about Trevor Lewis money would be great. And if you can find kind of the mojo that made him one of the more worrisome Coyotes, not that there are a lot of them, but one of the more worrisome Coyotes that the Kings played in the last few years, that's going to be exceptional for the Kings' bottom six.
Yeah, and Trevor Lewis was a 14-goal scorer this year, and Reeder is definitely capable of bringing that kind of offense to the table.
The bottom six to score 10 goals, that would actually go a long way towards improving. Great. So, you know, if you double that, if you say, now, if we can just get our top six guys to score an average of 20 goals a season, you're going to have some guys who are going to do about 15 on that third and the second line. But if you can average somewhere around 20 goals on in your top six per person, and 10 goals per person in your bottom six, you'll be slightly better than league average. And you won't have to worry as much about getting offensive contribution from your bottom six, like we've been worried about since, I don't know, 50 years now that this team has been around?
Well, since 2014. I mean, I think the Kings, since that season, I've written about it. Yeah, I remember writing about it a lot, and they still haven't filled it. And it's hard to fill, so I'll preface what I'm going to say. But they still haven't found a reliable third-line center. I think that more than anything is a sore spot. Kempe showed a lot of potential, but he's not what I would call reliable yet, consistent yet. He has all the talent in the world. I did want to bring up too, in terms of Kings forward, I think maybe a bigger question though than even a bottom six, and a bottom six is a glaring concern. But I think an even bigger question is, who is the real Tyler Toffoli? Who is the real Tanner Pearson? I thought Toffoli was a sure 30-goal guy every year in, year out. Last season, Toffoli was bad. I thought, injuries, whatever, right? So he starts off hot this season, and then he tapers off. And that's a concern to the Kings for the money he's making. Pearson, kind of the same thing. Pearson, you need him to be a regular 20-goal guy. You need Toffoli to be a regular 30-goal guy for a team that lacks secondary scoring, lacks a lot of kind of scoring. You need those guys to be in that place every year. And I know that both Pearson and Toffoli, they do a lot of little great things in their game when they're not scoring. But I think that I expected more from both of them this season. And if they're not providing it, then that increases your scoring concerns, because I wouldn't necessarily count on Kopitar having a heart-like season again and, you know, logging Brown on his back like he did this year too.
So Toffoli, I was
and
expecting
one of...
him. Sorry. I'm sorry, Eric. You unleashed
all
the beast here.
Nope. It's all yours.
I expect it to be between about a 50-point player, and that's about, he came close to that this year. 24 goals, 23 assists. It's clear that he missed Jeff Carter. He missed Jeff Carter like crazy, and I think with a healthy Jeff Carter, he can probably get closer to 30 goals. But my concern with Toffoli is that he's making 4.6, which might be a little much if he's only going to do 25. And I say only 25 for a team that has issues scoring. But honestly, I'm not that super concerned about Toffoli, because, I mean, he quietly kind of had a really decent season. Tanner Pearson had a season, I think his career high in assists of 25, but Pearson has always been slightly less talented than Toffoli, and it sounds really terrible if you say it like that, but he's never been quite as good as Toffoli, and there's a reason why he did slide to number 30, and they took him as a quote-unquote overager when he was 20 years old, whereas everybody was shocked that Toffoli somehow slid to the Kings in the second round at like 36 or something, whatever number he was drafted at. Something ridiculous. But for, let's see, Tanner Pearson is making 3.75. So I would like to see them, I think they need a backup plan for Jeff Carter. And that's my concern with the Kings. since 2014 was the last real viable year for Stoll, which again sounds really terrible. It makes him sound like he's a, I don't know, a petri dish or something. But clearly, Stoll was like playing above his head. Now, I think you get 3C, as Shane said. You need like a legit 3C, and I'm not talking Thompson or Mitchell or trying to force Kempe or Amadio in that spot.
Well, the point though is that they're not out there that readily, or the Kings would have filled that spot years ago. You know, they've tried with Shore, they tried with Dowd, they tried with a whole list of people that have been lacking.
Yeah,
I think
no,
the dream scenario for the Kings is that Gabe Vilardi comes in and seizes that next year and doesn't let go. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big ask for someone who was just drafted last summer. But I think I think you guys are right. I think if Vilardi isn't ready for that kind of responsibility, and maybe, you know, he can be a three center in the sense that he plays, you know, with two decent forwards and gets his 15 minutes a game. But the Kings 3C is somebody who has to do more than that, I think, in a lot of respects. He's got to play solid defense, and he's got to, you know, if you're talking about what Stoll did in the past and what Kempe did at points this year, and especially guys like Shore did and Thompson, and being asked to carry some of the defensive load, you know, I think Vilardi's capable of bringing the 3C scoring next year, but I also don't know if that's what they really need from that guy. Like, you look at Toffoli, he scored 24 goals, and they're looking it up, there were 67 guys this year in the NHL that scored more than that. So if you're expecting 24 goals from your third leading goal scorer is about right by the standards of the league. Kopitar and Brown were both up in the top 50 in goals scored. So based on sort of league average, that's fine. But I agree. I don't think Brown is going to be a 28 goal scorer next season. So you need Toffoli or you need Carter to seize that, seize the means of production. And with Kopitar and Carter, you can hopefully expect those two to get in that 25 to 30 goal range, you know, even if things go south for him a little bit. But it's, you know, if you have Brown producing, you're capable of having Toffoli and Pearson as your 4 and 5 goal scorers, and that's fine. But if you want Toffoli to be the guy he was a couple of years ago when he was, you know, up north of 30 and leading the Kings in goals for large chunks of the season, then maybe it is a bit of a concern.
I guess that's I had to concede that that's probably you're right that 24 for the money he's making is not bad. 24 goals for money he's making is not bad, especially at his age. But I think I expected more though. I think the Kings probably for them to really make another leap, they'll need more from him for them to kind of be a bubble team, which it does look more like that's who they are. Then it's fine. But yeah, if they want to make a leap as a team, then they'll need more from him.
They just need a really hot young talent. They need a Pasternak. They need not a McDavid, but they need a McKinnon. They need a Giroux. They need...
Well, every team needs those, right?
They grow on trees.
I mean, Arizona.
If we look like realistically, a guy like Kempe could make more of a leap. He has the talent. You make a good point with Vilardi. Vilardi might be capable of stepping in, and I think that I may be kind of an old mode of thinking in terms of saying that the Kings need a 3C like a Stoll type, because maybe they don't, you know. Maybe they have a more offensive third line, and then maybe they balance that with the fourth line, which is more capable of playing more than 8 minutes a night or whatever. And then that's how you balance that out, a more defensive fourth line, but that can also drive play a little more than Nate Thompson can, kind of like what Vegas has, for example, with Belmar. So there are kind of a little margins where the Kings can improve, but we'll have to see though. We'll have to see.
I mean, I know they're bumping up against the salary cap, and that is largely because Lombardi was trying so desperately to recapture glory, but I think there's a lot that they can do or that they should do to kind of re-examine where they're at. And I think that's one of the things that Blake was looking at with, why am I blanking on his name? He was just knocked out of the playoffs with Columbus, the Finnish guy. Anyway, I was really sad that they decided to waive him because he was, like, quietly, like, pushing play for the Kings. But
you mean Jokinen?
Yes, thank you.
Oh. Yeah, you see.
He was actually one of the better possession players, and I was like, why are you waiving him? But I guess things just weren't quite working out, and the same with Camilleri.
Yeah, I don't think possession is necessarily what they emphasize in LA. So.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I'm saying he was driving play, and when everybody else was not, and that really surprised me. And I dug into his numbers a little bit earlier this season, and I was gonna do it later in the season, but then I stopped and got lazy. But yeah.
Also, too, didn't he end up in Vancouver? I'm just looking at his. He played with four teams this year. Actually, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he bounced.
I know he started in Edmonton, LA, Columbus, ended up in Vancouver finally. Actually, so
poor thing.
But in terms of style, though, I mean, if I'm understanding where you're going with this, that maybe stylistically he's trying to go. Blake was probably trying. Looking to go away from the Sutter Lombardi model, and you could also see that with getting rid of a guy like Nolan. So maybe there will be a little bit more movement in that area too. As good a soldier as Kyle Clifford has been, and the Andrioff, maybe you don't need two of those guys on the team. You know, one is enough.
And even a guy like Shore, who was a possession driver in a big way for the Kings, he was starting shifts in the defensive zone and driving the other way. But there was, you know, clearly that sort of touch was missing. And that's what I think is interesting about Pearson. It's sort of been a running joke on the podcast this season where I criticize Tanner Pearson and then realize that he's got a career high in assists going. And that's sort of the way it's been for Pearson this year, where his contributions have been more quiet than past seasons. And maybe this is the place.
No. We have to look at it harder, though. Are they first assist or second assist? Primary assist?
Oh, I don't know. But
I'm curious. I'm going to look that up.
I mean, a lot of it has been. But he's been putting himself in front of the net more than he's done in past seasons. Like, that was a noticeable difference for Pearson, was the net front play. And he's, you know, I think the Kings should be. You know, I think they can be content with the Pearson they have now, and hope that you get a couple more 25 goal seasons out of him somewhere down the line. But I think it's a conversation that's going to continue next season as we see the team molded a little bit more in Blake's image and maybe in Stevens' image, seeing what the Kings are capable of. And you know, maybe this is a moot point, and maybe Vegas is going to win the division by 20 points next season, right, Shay?
Yeah, for sure. I guarantee it.
For sure. Well, I think on that note, we're going to sort of bring this to an end. So Shang and Robin, thanks again for jumping on. There's a long off season ahead, unfortunately, for the Kings.
Kopitar
has
though?
Been nominated. Oh, please. Please, more bad news. Go ahead.
Yes. So Pearson's second assist rate this season, 5-on-5, was a career high by a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But
his assist rate was also a career high overall,
yeah,
right?
Know,
it was
but,
his first
you know, but we're looking. Assist. But we want to emphasize first assist, which he had a decent amount of first assists, but his career high in that was actually a couple of years ago. Whereas his second assist, he had, at least according to rate stats, he had about five times more second assists this season, 0.12 to 0.66. So,
okay.
So
well,
some of those
we'll just
might have been a little little filler.
Well, at any rate, well, great.
Speaking of rates,
hopefully he makes up for it in the goals department next season, because that's a very fair point, and it's you know, maybe bringing Carter back will help him a little bit. Maybe having more time with Kopitar will help him too. But it's going to be an off season that's interesting to see the approach. Assuming the Kings can't bring in a ton of talent, you know, we might see more of those sort of tinkering type moves. A lot of which, as you said, worked out. Some of which, you know, maybe in Phaneuf's example, didn't always work out, but provided at least what Blake was looking for, good or bad. But hopefully, you know, hopefully the Kings make some strides with this lineup. Andre Kopitar is a Selke finalist, potentially a Hart finalist, and Drew Doughty again is a Norris Trophy finalist. So there's, you know, the core is not going to change. And the Kings, I don't think, are going to be...
Yeah, Quick had one of his better seasons, actually.
Yeah, Quick had a good year. If they have another, you know, if they do the same thing they've done the last five or so years, which is find a backup and make him good and get a useful piece for him, that's always a nice assembly line. Go ahead, Robin.
I think that's your backup for next season, Eric.
Well, what?
You said hopefully if they you know, go out and find a backup, and I said I think his name is Jack Campbell.
Yes, and he's the shining star, I think, at this point. What was the save percentage last year? 940.
I wonder if Peterson can come up too, because I know that they like Peterson a lot.
I don't think he's ready.
Well,
I saw him, and he's definitely not even close to ready. Like, I saw him play with the Rain against the Cuda like a month ago, and he was okay. He definitely kept his team in it when they were looking a little shaky, especially on the penalty kill. But I'm concerned about some of the goals that he sometimes gives up.
Well, I'm not a goalie. I always defer to that with other people. But just from what I've heard, he's competing with Clegg for basically the second best prospect in the system. For sure, Vilardi is number one. There isn't any contention for that.
Yeah.
But they like Peterson a lot. I don't know if that means he'll play next year in LA. He maybe, like you said, he can use another year of seasoning. But I think he definitely could be a candidate for the backup.
It sounds like the plan is, and I think this is John Rosen talking, the plan was for Peterson to get a spot start here and there, maybe start five games for the Kings next season. Give him a taste, especially I think if the Kings are either well in it or well out of it down the stretch, that,
yeah,
you know,
that
we might
reasonable.
See Peterson, and we might see him if there's injury. But yeah, Vardy and Peterson and Clegg, hopefully, you know, best case scenario, they're sort of the Kopitar, Doughty, Quick, albeit, you know, that's a once in a lifetime forward defenseman goalie core. But I think the Kings are hoping that they can get some contributions from all three of those guys by 2 years from now.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that all pans out. But we're already looking ahead to 2019, which means I guess we're good at moving on quickly.
A lot of optimism shown on this broadcast.
Oh, always.
But
in the meantime, Sheng, good luck with the rest of the playoffs.
Thank you.
I hope that Vegas keeps this exciting for you guys.
I just want to go to Nashville.
I think
Nashville's great.
Oh, yeah. Hey, four more wins.
If they don't go beyond Nashville or the conference finals, it's fine. Hoping for Nashville over Winnipeg. That's all I'm hoping for. So,
you don't
want
to go to Winnipeg?
Them not to get past. I expect them not to get past either of those teams, but...
I'm sure Winnipeg is lovely this time of year, Chang.
I've heard good things about Winnipeg. People tell me there's good stuff there, but, I mean, Nashville is Nashville. Nashville is awesome. I went last year. It's so fun. I love that place. Also, too, in Nashville, I don't have to wait 2 hours for hot chicken like you have to do in downtown L.A.
Alan Ray's.
Exactly. Not worth it. I waited for 3 hours for Halloween Ray's. It's a half hour wait, please.
Well, we only.
All right, I'll go on a Monday at 3 p.m. So on that hot note, we'll go ahead and call it a podcast. I think the playoffs are going to be good. Nashville Winnipeg is a chance to be this year's version of maybe a Chicago LA series with two juggernauts. But we're going to be bitter about it because we don't get to watch the Kings. But again, Sheng, hope it goes well for you. Keep doing your thing.
Thank you.
And for everybody listening, we'll have more off-season stuff for you. We might have some news on Hart nominees in the next couple days, and we'll get to talk about that. And in the meantime, I think fairly soon be launching into some of our season review content, talking about the different players and their performances this season, and then looking ahead to the draft and to free agency into the futures of some of these guys. So we'll be back for our next JewelCast, I assume, in May, probably earlier May. But in the meantime, enjoy the rest of the playoffs, and we'll all be back soon. Thanks.
Bye, guys.
Bye.